It's Monday, July 22nd, 2024, from Peach Fish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, the old switcheroo. For years, I've wondered, will there ever be a new switcheroo? And we just saw it. The Democrats did it. They switched out the old for the new. Kamala Harris will now be their standard bearer, an example of the new switcheroo. I do wonder, however, how do you keep, if you're the Democrats, how do you keep making the case that Donald Trump is something of a death knell for democracy when the Democratic candidate didn't win one vote in the nominating process, wasn't the choice of a single voter this year, nor the winner of a single delegate in 2020? I know the Republicans will raise this because Stephen Miller has been at maximum intensity.
They held a primary. People, they had ballots. They filled out circles. They went to the voting booths. They spent money on advertisements. And as President Trump said, the Republican Party spent tens of millions of dollars running against Joe Biden. Now they just woke up one morning and said, never mind, we're canceling the entire primary. We're getting rid of our candidate, and we're pretending the election has never even happened, and we're going to let donors handpick a new nominee?
Well, it wasn't just donors. It was everyone in the Democratic firmament. Also, she is vice president. That is the kind of logical next person up situation. But even if Miller makes the point designed to appeal mostly to an already Democrat suspicious audience, there is something of a fair point in there, isn't there? I think so. Yes, elections and democracy, though similar and having overlap, aren't the same thing. And when it's argued that Donald Trump is a danger to democracy, it doesn't have to mean there'll never, ever be another election. There are, of course, plenty of countries that have a lot of elections, failed or failing countries, right? Nicolas Maduro is actually running in an election in Venezuela. Of course, he persecuted and banned so many rivals and is somehow the nominee of 13 different parties, but it is an election. Putin wins elections, quote unquote. So I get all that. But Trump, this time around, did go to the polls, did go before voters, said, vote for me, beat his rivals. They did vote for him. And he is the nominee because voters in the primary actually wanted him to be the nominee, will of the voters and all that. None of that is true for Kamala Harris, whose main case is that she is the defender of the democratic process, small d in this case. Like I said, I don't think that what Stephen Miller was making, or the more reasonable, less shouty version of it, is the worst point in the world, and I do know Republicans will raise it, and then Harris will have to combat it. I think a good comeback is something like, well, vote for me, and then we'll solve all your problems right there. Donald Trump won't ruin democracy, and I will get to be an example of democracy working. Let's see what case she does make. The earliest of early voting, North Carolina, begins in 87 days. On the show today, the problem of immigration and how Harris got smeared as a czar when she's really something more of a sociologist slash diplomat. But first, The New Yorker's Benjamin Wallace Wells, like me, fresh from Milwaukee and the RNC, has been covering the Democrats and the Republicans and the interplay thereof. So we next talk about the decision to jettison President Biden, how that was finally arrived at, what strengths and weaknesses Kamala Harris brings to the race, what options Democrats really had for someone else, and should I feel free to call him Ben? I promise we emerge from this interview with at least one of those questions solidly put to bed. So you may have heard Joe Biden is stepping out of the 2024 race. He has endorsed Kamala Harris. How the Republicans will respond, how the Democrats will respond, and have played it to this point, will pretty much determine the course of our nation. Benjamin Wallace Wells is a New Yorker magazine staff writer, has been since 2015. He was at the RNC. He's been chronicling the course of Republican intellectualism and tactical strategy. Also has been checking in on the Bidens and what his retinue has been advising. Ben, welcome to The Gist.
It's great to be with you.
Let's do a little bit of scene setting or catch us up to how Joe Biden, what you know of how Joe Biden and his inner circle made their decision. I want to ask you, they were making a lot of arguments publicly resisting change. You had a good quote in there. This was from a few days ago. Davos Dems love to hedge their bets against us and get hysterical. This is a Biden loyalist poo-pooing anyone who would tell him to leave the race. Another big phrase was bedwetting. People who think that Joe Biden shouldn't win are just, they're not tough enough. They don't have what it takes. My question is, what arguments do you think they believed, and what were the ones that you just think they were making because they thought it might work?
Trump, you know, and the reporting we'd heard earlier about Biden's skepticism of sort of stepping back so that Kamala Harris might step forward and be the nominee was, I don't know if she can do it. I don't know if she can win, you know? And so it seems that the thing that, kind of turned the key was sort of polling that said, you know, no, this may be completely out of reach for Biden.
Right. So maybe the calculation became less can she win and more I really have to admit, or my people around me who are helping me come to this decision really have to admit that at this point I can't.
And I think that, you know, one contributing factor, maybe it's not as strong as other Democrats might have hoped it would be, but certainly one contributing factor is that functionally, with the exception of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, functionally the whole Democratic Party by the end had turned on a Biden reelection and was calling for him to get out. And when you're hearing from, you know, more moderate or conservative Democrats who are running in frontline districts that are, you know, up for grabs, and at the same time you're hearing from, you know, from the Jamie Raskins of the world, leaders of the Progressive Caucus, you know, you're hearing from people who are close to you know, other candidates who might supplant you, but also people who are not close to those candidates. You know, when Nancy Pelosi, of all people, you know, such an institutionalist is leaving the party. I mean, I think it became at a certain level untenable. I'd add one small thing, which I think was not, you know, essential, but is interesting in light of what's happened in the last 24 hours, which is that his ability to raise funds for this effort had completely dried up. You know, he had raised in July, I think they said 25% of what their target was, almost immediately after things flip, after Kamala Harris is the candidate. Tens and tens of millions of dollars pour in just over the last 24 hours. This is both from small dollar donors and from big dollar donors. So that's not, I don't think that's the thing that tipped it, but I do think that is another indication of just the breadth of skepticism that Biden could continue that existed a week ago.
Yeah, there are many theories of politics. The party decides, the money decides, the left or right flank, depending on which party you're talking about. Right. And any, whatever your theory is, they were all deciding, you're pointing out, for Biden to get out of the race. I do want to ask you, it did strike me as interesting and unusual that you said AOC, Bernie Sanders still supporting him. What about Fetterman, who you reported on a lot? I thought he was still pretty much behind Biden.
Absolutely, very staunchly. And has, given some kind of slightly, you know, characteristically jaded and bitter, you know, statements about the process over the last 24 hours.
That's right. Classic grumpy ogre Fetterman. But how do you explain the left coming to his defense? Is it just transactional? We think we could get more concessions?
It's interesting. I don't know that I have a great account. I did talk to Ro Khanna, who is, you know, maybe not quite as far left as Bernie and AOC, but still in that part of the party, a couple of weeks ago. And what he said to me is, you know, we've always been, the left has always been more about policy and less about character, you know, and if you are on board with, you know, what we want, if you're delivering some things that we want, we're for it. I think in this particular case, in the last couple of days, you know, of his campaign, Biden was throwing out some very expansive sort of policy ideas that seemed directly taken from Bernie around, you know, federal rent control regulation and things like that. My guess is that, you know, that was, you know, sort of part of that transaction. But, you know, also maybe that they just miscalculated and they thought that, you know, he would survive and then he didn't.
Yes. So Biden is out for all the reasons that we all saw that you reported on. It was not a fait accompli that would mean that Kamala Harris was in. How did it become a fait accompli?
I think we'll learn more in the coming days. I can give you my current view, which is that, you know, she was better positioned than most people thought. You know, one of the things that's been striking to me is how many, you know, large unions have come out very quickly and said, you know, we are behind her. There's been some reporting about her, you know, depth of connections to, you know, the labor movement, for instance. I don't say that to say that, like, you know, Sean Fain and the UAW did this or something, but just to say that, you know, this is a person who has had, you know, 4 years now to get increasingly networked with all kinds of folks at the National Democratic Party. And I think she was in a little bit stronger position than we thought. I think also, you know, we're just kind of late in the game. And, you know, I think that there had been such a push that was, you know, back and forth and delayed and, you know, it, you know, kind of artificially extended by Biden waiting for this development and that development. And, you know, we're, what are we, 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks from the convention right now? You know, I think that, like, there was a desire among a lot of Democrats to get this done with. And last of all, I'll say, you know, having profiled Gretchen Whitmer last year and talked to, you know, some folks around her, but also around other candidates, I don't know that any of the other, like, theorized alternatives had been really prepping to run, were sure that Biden was going to drop out, were ready in any way to present themselves as a viable alternative. You know, people talk a lot about Josh Shapiro, you know, as a potential alternative to Kamala Harris. People talked about Whitmer. People talked about Gavin Newsom. I didn't see a ton from them that said, yeah, we are putting ourselves forward as alternatives to Harris. And so, you know, I think there was, you know, a little bit of a suddenness to how this came down. And, you know, she was maybe better networked than we thought. And there was also a little bit of an absence of other alternatives stepping forward. And all those people who were, you know, discussed as potential presidential candidates are now being discussed as potential vice presidential candidates.
Well, the labor, I'll say a couple of things about that. One is, of the three you mentioned, I think this is just my impression that Newsom, has a large staff and he's very skilled. And if it came down to it, he'd be like, okay, I'll run. I'll do it tomorrow. Whitmer, on the other hand, always said, you know, no, I'm not interested. And these are people who knew that Joe Biden wasn't the most robust candidate even 2 years ago, and they did not go the Dean Phillips route. So it doesn't surprise me that they wouldn't stick to that particular game plan, that it was better to keep their powder dry for a future run and not upset the party.
I agree with you that Newsom's the outlier there. I mean, I would just say also, you know, Whitmer is, you know, a pretty rigid person, I think. And I think she's been planning for 2028 for a long time. And I think it was, you know, a little bit, you know, she didn't want to, like, move off of that. Shapiro's just been governor for a couple years, you know, and, like, this is pretty quick for something like this to come up.
It is funny. People who prize government and governance will say, well, that's really important. But of course, people who don't will say vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance.
Yeah. Yeah. equally quick. But I don't know that Republicans are feeling great about Vance right now. You know, like he is somebody who, if you are confident that you're going to win and you need somebody who, you know, speaks to your base as an heir to Trump, does seem like a compelling candidate. If you are not confident that you're going to win and you need somebody who's going to appeal to swing voters, he is pretty young. He is pretty, like, extreme, especially in socially conservative ways. And I do wonder if, I thought he made a compelling presentation at the RNC, but I do wonder if he becomes a real asset to this campaign over the next few months, or if the Republicans will wind up wishing that they had somebody with some more obvious sort of bipartisan appeal, you know, to run with it. So,
you know, but back to Kamala being anointed, appointed, the designee. I tweeted that I think the Democrats need a Hail Mary, and this is a handoff. Though I totally understand why, when you make a unprecedented move like this, and you can't look to LBJ or any other decision, when you do something that's this much of a radical break with that which is expected, you then want to have every other decision be the most conservative one in a way. So I totally understand that. But I have, I think, a different conception of how far behind any Democrat would be. And I thought they did need something, not, you know, notwithstanding what you said about the other three prominent Democrats in waiting, actually not wanting to. What do you think? What are people telling you? What do internal polls say about just how behind even a Harris would be?
you know, she'd definitely be behind. You know, and I think there is another element here that's worth taking into account, which is that, you know, Biden's sort of decline was discussed mostly in terms of what's happening in this campaign and how viable he'll be in this campaign, and maybe a little bit like, you know, what will he actually look like in 4 years? Like, what is he asking for here? I think it's also important going backwards. I think that we have 4 years of Biden being like a pretty inattentive attacker of Trump, you know, a pretty inattentive political combatant, and a pretty, you know, low key promoter and defender of his own administration's policies. And you're asking Kamala Harris to come in 3 or 4 months before the election in a position where she is, because she has been vice president, just going to have to, you know, stand on the record of this administration. I don't think she can really, like, I don't think she's going to be like as associated with like the Israel-Gaza war as Biden was, for instance. There's going to be elements that will be a little bit different, but basically she's going to have to, you know, make a case for what this administration has been. And she's got a huge deficit there. You know, the Biden administration is really unpopular, you know, on basic things like who do you trust more to handle the economy? Trump has huge advantages that have been built over years, you know? And so people may not like him. They may even like Kamala Harris a little more. Who knows, you know? But, you know, there is still this, I think the basic dynamic of this election, if I were to say, what was the basic dynamic of this election before this change, I would have said, you know, the last two presidential elections have fundamentally been anti-incumbency elections, and this one looks like it's going to be exactly the same, you know. And, you know, is this enough to, you know, stave that off, to withstand the argument that, you know, these guys, Biden and Harris, have had 4 years, and like, you know, what have you really gotten for it? You know, don't you feel like you were better off in 2018, 2019, you know? Like, I think that there is, you know, beyond this sort of deficit in the polls, there is this question of you know, this administration has not been very well defended for the last few years, and now she's got a lot to make up. I will say on one last thing on the polls, I mean, the Democrats have been saying for this whole election that the likeliest strategy for them, the likeliest map for them, as I'm sure you've discussed, is like to recreate the blue wall, right? You know, and, mm-hmm. and win Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and the one district in the one electoral vote that comes out of Omaha, basically, you know, because Nebraska has a divided way of doing its electoral votes. Kamala is probably a better candidate for the Democrats overall, slightly. You know, it's not apparent that she will be better in the upper Midwest. Biden always had a particular strength there. The voters there are older, you know, they're more white than they are in the country as a whole, mm-hmm. you know. And so are we still looking at a situation where, you know, the Democrats with Harris still think that's their best opportunity? Do things like Georgia and Arizona, do states like Georgia and Arizona come back into play? And I think, like, you know, I assume we'll have some indication of where she's going to go with the VP choice relatively soon. And, you know, that probably gives us some indication of what their internal polls are saying. But my guess would be they've still got to pull off the Midwest. And she's like not the ideal candidate that you designed to do that.
Right. But as you just said, she probably would be better than Biden just because how youthful Arizona is, how diverse Georgia is. She'll get back some of the slipping black coalition. She certainly will. I mean, just the fact that she doesn't have the deficiencies of Biden. I'm not saying that Kamala Harris is, you know, to the youth what Charlie XTC is. And right. I only mentioned that because they changed their color scheme to try to pretend she was. But yeah, I'll say that's true. Let's also go back to what you said about the economy. Yes, Republicans have advantages there, but I don't think this is all of it. But exactly how you pointed out that Joe Biden has been a deficient spokesman, I think that is enormously important. And if he had even had one iota of the salesmanship of Donald Trump talking about how often did Donald Trump talk about how great the stock market was under him? It's better under Biden and people don't even know that. Or the employment rate is better under Biden. He doesn't talk up his economic policy at all. And the question is, can Kamala, is there a track record? Has she just been able to do this, but quiet, not unleashed while she's been in the administration? And now she's going to come shot out of a cannon and we'll all know, oh my God, because Kamala Harris made the point, we realize the economy is much better than it was. I doubt it.
And I think the thing that you would point to making that case would be the 2020, you know, primaries. And, you know, having covered those, this was not a situation where, you know, Joe Biden came out and everybody said, oh my God, we love this guy. You know, we want this guy to be president. He just screams the future to us. You know, he was, what did he finish, third and fourth in Iowa and New Hampshire? You know,
yes.
I remember being in Iowa at an event he did. And he didn't even close his own event. He sat down and let a young congresswoman give
right. The, and I remember reading that story you wrote, and you wrote there, this is weird.
It's so weird. You know, I've never seen that before. And beyond that, you know, we are now looking. It's slightly different people, but we're now looking at the Democratic bench, so to speak, the other, you know, sort of national Democratic candidates. And a lot of people in the press and certainly many Democratic activists are saying, you know, oh my God, any of these people could make a case that Biden couldn't. Any of them stands a better chance. But the truth is, in 2020, a lot of those people, including Harris, stood up and tried to make their case, and it fell really flat, you know, and she sounded pretty vague. A lot of the time she went a little bit back and forth on, you know, very key questions like whether she planned to, you know, eliminate private medical insurance or not, you know, but also there was just a kind of, a vagueness, a kind of fogginess about what she actually meant to do. There are some people who have tracked Harris very closely, more closely than I, over recent months and said she's better, but exactly what that means and, you know, exactly what her facility is.
Yeah,
making a kind of economic case. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you said earlier in this interview the mood is anti-incumbency. Guess what? There's only one incumbent in the race, and it's not the current office holder, is it?
Right. I think there is something to that. I mean, if you're, one thing that, like, you know, there's a little bit of a parlor game, but like one thing I think a lot of us have been trying to figure out, like watching all these European elections, because, you know, there has been throughout the Trump era, this kind of like pattern that ties together, you know, what's happening overseas and what's happening here is, you know, what is the story that links together, you know, the Indian election, the French elections, and, you know, Meloni's continued strength in Italy, and, you know, Scholz struggling to keep his coalition together in Germany. And it does, and you know, Starmer, without making an incredibly compelling case, you know, totally swamping the conservatives, you know, after, what is it, 14 years of rule in the UK. And I think the clearest story you have there, though there's a lot, and, you know, maybe this one is wrong, the clearest story you have is anti-incumbency, is that, you know, after COVID and after the kind of, like, you know, economic pattern we've had, people are ready to throw out the, you know, the people in charge. And, you know, is Kamala able to both embody and defend, you know, the sort of status quo? That's a big question. And I'll say one other, like, thing here, which is just, you know, I think a real question right now is, what is the next big thing for Democrats to do? You know, like, the Biden 2020 campaign was largely an anti-Trump campaign. You know, it did not propose, as Sanders had, as Obama had, as Kerry had, as Gore had, you know, as Clinton had, a big forward-looking sort of social program or way of thinking about what the Democrats are that would change, you know, how people perceived of the party and provide a kind of agenda going forward. You know, are we still going to try to, you know, continue to expand healthcare? Is that what the Democrats are up to? Is it, you know, are they going to try to build much more housing in cities as, you know, as Recline would like to? And this is something that, you know, Starmer and Labour in the UK have talked about too, you know, beyond saying those other guys are so crazy, you certainly don't want them. You know, what are the Democrats going to propose that liberalism is about, their party is about going forward? And, you know, it's probably appropriate that we're now, whatever it is, 20 minutes into this interview, and this is the first we've talked about, like, what the plans for a Harris administration would be. It may not actually be that important. But I think that, you know, some of the ambiguity about, you know, what the Democrats stand for, whether they deserve another term, I don't think it's just about the kind of retroactive, did they do anything, you know, that changed my life in their first term? I think there's a little bit of uncertainty about what the vision is exactly, you know, especially if we're now in a space, I think we are, where it's not assumed that the future is going to be, you know, left, as I think people were assuming for a while after 2016 and after the Bernie movement.
Do you think protect abortion, grow the economy is aspirational enough?
We'll see. You know, I mean, I think, you know, like, I, you know, if I, if I were betting right now on what would happen, what will happen in this election, I think Trump will win. But I think it's pretty close, and I could be persuaded, you know, a lot of different ways in 2 weeks. If you ask me where the polls are on Labor Day, I could see, you know, Harris down 5. I could see her up 5. You know, it's
really
feels, yeah, I think so. You know, it feels really wide open to me. And wow. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. You seem more locked in than that, or to think the electorate's more locked in than that.
Ah, the polls up. I have, can Harris, like, nationally, yeah, I'm thinking of these swing states. I'd just say, wow. And without Donald Trump doing something crazy, which Donald Trump could do something crazy, I really don't know.
Yeah.
He could do something crazy and people will price it in and not care. Also, that could happen.
Also true.
Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer for The New Yorker. I thank you for your time. I thank you, of course, for letting me call you Ben. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Anytime.
And now the spiel. Immigration was the number one actual issue, not the number one or most prevalent theme, vibe, or free-floating critique of values at the Republican National Convention last week. Immigration. Prices, those were also critiqued. And maybe a content analysis of speakers would actually reveal that high prices under Biden plus the ubiquitous claim of best economy under Trump did outpace immigration talk. But if so, only by a little. And to me, most talk of prices in the economy was somewhat impressionistic, whereas the border talk was more specific. It wasn't that you feel that there's a crisis at the border. It was more you feel high prices, there is a crisis at the border. The crisis at the border is also more policy oriented. And it's also not true that there is some agreed upon policy that would yield economic prosperity. If there is, why don't they do it? And don't give me the because oligarchs control blah, blah, blah. What is the plan? But there is, to take the immigration issue, there is a policy that would, of course, decrease immigration. And if you want to ask, why don't they do it? Well, it's because the trade-offs are hard in a democracy or for people who value the lives and situations of others. 99% of Americans want a better economy. A much smaller percentage of Americans want mass deportations, which marks the mainstay of Republican policy prescriptions. And while most Americans want less immigration, the way to get there isn't agreed upon. I'll throw something else into the mix. When Democrats and Republicans did come up with a bipartisan plan, not a solution, but a shot at progress, it was scotched by Trump acolytes who preferred the election issue to the potential solution. Now, here's a poll, a Gallup poll from earlier this year. Immigration surges to top of most important problem list. First time immigration has been the single most important problem since 2019. Gallup also asks another poll, but it goes deeper than that because here's this other poll I want to talk about. They ask this question, in your view, should immigration be kept at its present level, increased or decreased? All right. The latest poll from June, a month ago, shows that a majority, 55% of Americans, say immigration should be decreased. And the last year, if you're thinking to yourself, well, America's always been a somewhat hostile country to immigration, listen to this. The last year, a majority of Americans said it should be decreased was 2005. And the last year, as many as 55% of Americans said it should be decreased was just a month after 9/11, 2001. So this is a big issue, even if Democrats don't want it to be or think it's being demagogued or blame the cruelty, lies, and racism of the right in convincing Americans to care as much as they care. And they do care. I have also documented, you've heard me talk about, how Republican solutions come with costs that are less popular in many cases than the fixes. So the Republicans don't have a plan, per se. They do, however, have a villainess.
Joe Biden and his designated border czar, Kamala Harris.
Border czar, Vice President Harris.
And Joe Biden's border czar, Kamala Harris.
Who's ready to retire Joe Biden and border czar Kamala Harris and send her back to California?
The border czar
Kamala Harris.
That was a brother of a crime victim and four Republican Senate candidates. The last, Tom Cotton, literally doing the air quotes gesture around the phrase border czar. I think Cotton was implying that the originator of the quotes, right, he's quoting someone, and I think he wants you to believe that he's quoting Joe Biden or the Biden administration, that he appointed her, quote, border czar, but he did no such thing. The originator of the quotes are the Republicans branding her appointment as that of a border czar. Biden famously or infamously to Democrats and to the desire of Republicans put Kamala Harris in charge of one aspect of the complicated situation that is immigration into the United States.
But I've asked her, the VP today, because she's the most qualified person to do it, to lead our efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle and the countries that help us. We're going to need help in stemming the movement of so many folks, stemming the migration to our southern border.
Yes, and we heard that announcement ends with the phrase stemming the migration at our southern border. And it might make her seem like she's approving timesheets for the border control at Eagle Pass or okaying overtime at San Ysidro. It is not the case. This was a diplomatic effort. This was between nations, the United States and our relations with Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, to get them aid, to address crime, to carrot and stick our way to getting fewer people to leave those countries and come into ours. She was tasked with addressing the intangible and I think almost always frustrating idea of getting at root causes. But that was her job. And she said so in that infamous interview with Lester Holt after she falsely said, we've been to the border.
My focus is dealing with the root causes of migration. There may be some who think that that is not important. But it is my firm belief that if we care about what's happening at the border, we better care about the root causes and address them.
This wasn't a case of her retroactively trying to shirk responsibilities or a revision of the original intent. That is what the president always wanted Vice President Harris to do. Here he was 3 minutes after first saying she was to help, quote, in stemming the migration to our southern border.
And but the vice president's agreed among the multiple other things that have happened in the meeting, and I appreciate it, agreed to lead our diplomatic effort and work with those nations to accept the returnees and enhance migration enforcement at their borders. At their borders.
At their borders. Now, I would not say that Kamala Harris has been particularly successful at that, though you could argue that crime is way down in a couple of those Northern Triangle countries. But crime is probably down there due to authoritarian crackdowns that the Biden administration is pretty uneasy about. The point is that Kamala Harris has an opportunity to make clear that she was never the border czar. And even if it's a Latino guy making cracks about her, as was the case with Bob Unanue, the Goya CEO, Kamala Harris does not deserve this.
Our border czar, Kamala Harris. That means so bad. And we have enough bad. We need some good. We need goodness. Was missing in action.
Harris could credibly argue, I wasn't the border czar. I wasn't missing. You mistake or misstate my mission. But how does she do this without seeming to avoid responsibility? Not strictly speaking my fault. That is not the most rousing political message. Don't put it on a button. But there are ways she could finesse this and address this. Sound like Walt Frazier there for a second. She could make this or rebut the charges with an emphasis on Republican lies. She could talk about her criticism of mass deportations, which is an unpopular strategy. She could elucidate the new Biden-Harris administration policies that are working a little bit. They have at least coincided in a drop in border crossings since they put them into place, a freeze on amnesty. But it is, and she knows this, and we as voters, citizens, people paying attention, we very much need to be aware of this. This really is a big issue. And it's not unfair that it's a big issue. It's an issue that Americans are extremely concerned about and think the Democrats are doing rather poorly on. It's an issue that can't be ignored. And if this issue's salience sustains, you know, if it's still seen as the most important, that'll be bad for Democrats. But now, the presumed top Democrat has an argument at her disposal. The question will be, will she make the best argument she can, communicating progress without downplaying her responsibility? And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Our intern is Leo Neobuxbaumiabaum. Neobuxbaumia, the species of cactus that grow tree-like, branched or unbranched, and have a well-defined trunk of 30 meters in diameter and reach statures and heights of up to 15 meters. The thorns are stiff and pliable. The strong cylindrical gray-green shoots have numerous low ribs and tight-fitting areolas. That Neobuxbaumia? Yes, that's the one. Michelle Pesca is in charge of quail egg procurement for Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.